Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Satsang in the morning. Two questions. How can I be absolutely sure of non-duality? The Vedanta has to work as a pramana, as a means of knowledge, first of all. If it's just something intellectual, then it's not landing on what we call the vastu, about that which actually is non-dual. So to be absolutely sure of non-duality is to be sure that your being is non-dual. So that has to be recognized, along with the recognition that everything you can experience, or any given thing that can be objectified, is mithya. And so to understand that means that there's a lot of what we call prakriyas. There's a lot of teaching methodologies to make you recognize that this universe, internally and externally, anything that can be objective, has no substance. Any idea of a substance goes into what we call an infinite regress, because and the reason for that is that our means of knowledge can only perceive nama-rupa, basically, whether that's in the form of sound or what I can perceive visually in the form of color. Everything has what we call visheshas. They have attributes, differentiating attributes. So the whole creation can be divided up into like an infinite number of things. But if I try to analyze, take any given thing, if I analyze it and try to find out what that thing actually is, or if it has any substance, the answer will always be no. And that's just kind of a logical fact, because based upon the sense perception that you have, the five sense organs that you have, they're not able to see beyond nama-rupa, beyond name and form. If they were able to see beyond name and form, then they would see something which is non-dual, right? Something which has no name and form. If something has no name and form, then there's no division there. There's nothing to separate it. There just is. And that isness is actually what is beyond name and form. The sat is sat, the satyam, the being itself, is beyond name and form. But you can't see that. You can only be that. And so there are several different prakriyas to help you to understand that this creation has no independent being of its own, you know. And so therefore, it must be what we term as mithya. It must depend upon something other than the nama-rupa. Nama-rupa of whatever size, or however small, however big, that nama-rupa has to depend upon something for its substance, for its being. And that which it depends upon can never, ever be a name and form. It can never be a form, because that won't take us to the substance of the form. You know, that's just the form. What's inside the form? What's the being? What is the material cause of the form? Right? And so we can't answer that question by giving another form or another bunch of forms. That just evades the problem. It skips over the problem. And nor can we take off all the forms, you know. If we were to take off every single form, then we would be left with something we have no idea what it is, because we have no pramanas, no means of knowledge to to see it or to recognize it or to differentiate it in any way. You know? So what this type of external analysis does is establish what we mean by mitya, what we mean by this word mitya. So I was just talking about what we mean by the word mitya in terms of getting to the bottom of it, the getting finally to, oh, this is the substance. You can't do that with your means of knowledge. You can only get to smaller and smaller namarupas or bigger and bigger and bigger namarupas, you know, conglomerates, or take the conglomerates apart. That's what you can do. Then we have the problem within this creation of being everything in the creation itself being time-bound. And we say it is time-bound or subject to time because it's subject to change. Anything that is subject to change, just by this word change is enough, means the prior condition is, say there's a change. The prior condition is gone. It doesn't exist anymore. And then when it changes again, that condition is gone. It doesn't exist anymore. A new condition has come. So any change is bordered by non-existence of that particular thing, right? Because it that thing that has now come into being had no prior condition. And so because of that problem that we have in terms of time, we have to now go into, okay, well, what is the substance of that thing which is changing? That substance has to outlast the change, and then it can have a dependent reality on that substance. Right, like if we use the clay pot example. Like if I have a lump of clay and I make it into a pot and then smash it into a plate, the clay is outlasting the rise and fall of the pot. Right, and so then we can say that that pot is dependent upon the clay completely for its being. And so in that example, the pot becomes mitya because it has no being of its own. The only thing that's really there is clay. And so the nama rupa, and when we use that type of an illustration in terms of this time, that object, any given object, has to be dependent on something that actually exists in order for it itself to be, because on either side it has non-existence. So how to get to the being, the actual being of the pot, for instance, you know? You have to get to that substance which is there before, during, and after the pot, so that the pot can have the being which is actually that substance. So say we try to get to the bottom of, okay, what is the substance that itself exists? Does it come into being and go out of being? Because then it's just kind of a slower collapse. It's a slower collapse, means the clay lasts longer than the pot. The clay, which is bordered by non-existence, lasts longer than the pot. So that same clay can make a pot into a plate, into a tumbler, and back into the clay. But the clay itself comes into being and goes out of being. It also is mitya. But it has this kind of a relative satyam status of actually being existence itself. It has a relatively satyam status in reference to the clay, to the pot, but not in reference to itself, because it also comes into being and goes out of being. And so we go into an infinite regress there also. If we're having one namarupa depend upon kind of a bigger, longer lasting namarupa, and that namarupa depends on a bigger, longer lasting namarupa, but all of these namarupas themselves come into being and go out of being. So that's how we get stuck. Oh, what's the truth of the desk? Well, wood, of course. But then we stop there. We don't say, well, you know, what's the truth of wood? And it goes on and on and on and on, and all of the components of each one, they divide into many, many smaller namarupas, and each one of the namarupas comes into being, names, forms, comes into being and goes out of being. And so the more we analyze this creation, the more piles of mitya we get, right? It doesn't matter. You can go cause, effect. But as long as you're within the world of nama rupa, you still end up with the same problem, it has this mityatva. What does mitya mean? Is that it has no independent being of its own. Why? Because it's bordered by non-existence, and therefore it has to be dependent on something that outlasts it. But in the end, that thing that outlasts it has to be dependent on something that outlasts that. Outlast means before, during, and after. It is there for this nama-rupa to depend on. But that goes into an infinite regress. You know what infinite regress? It means it never stops, you know, because nothing all along the way has independent being. It always requires something else. And so as long as you're in the world of name and form, you're stuck. You're stuck with that. And your sense organs won't let you get out of it. Because your sense organs, they themselves and your means of knowledge are stuck within. It's kind of like as a jiva with this body, mind, sense organs. There's no way for us to hop out of the creation, you know, and look into it. And if we stay within the creation, then we're stuck in an infinite regress of mitya, and in terms of time, an infinite regress of mitya in terms of trying to find an actual thing there by dividing it up into smaller and smaller parts to find, well, where's the substance? You've divided it so many times that you don't even have the original object isn't even there, and you're still left with this minuscule, you know, object that has its little minuscule substance, which you can't find because you have no means of knowledge to see the substance. You only have means of knowledge to see the nama-rupa. So we go into this infinite regress that only continues infinitely to establish mitya. And that is because we have no means of knowledge to know a substance which is beginningless and endless. That means too, we have to have a means of knowledge to recognize what is existence itself, what is being itself. And that being can't have a beginning and an end, because then it's mitya. Then it exists within the world of change. So now, what doesn't have a beginning and an end, you know, is time-free, is timeless, that whatever it is, you know, whatever it is means it just is, it can't be a nama-rupa. If it's a name and form, it's only going to be talking about the name and form. And its substance is going to be just another nama-rupa that outlasts this nama-rupa, if you understand what I mean. Like clay and pot. If we use clay pot, that example is only good for one round. The relationship of the clay, of the pot to the clay. But if we go into, clay also is made of a bunch of little nama-rupas, then that drishtanta is no good anymore. We have to throw it out. So that drishtanta, that illustration is only good for the clay pot. The relationship of this pot to the clay. But clay is also a problem. It just outlasts the pot. It's there before, during, and after. So it's a good illustration. But the clay also isn't beginningless and endless, free of time. Right? And so what is free of time has to be free of nama-rupa. It can't be an object within the creation. Like yourself, you are not an object in the creation. And you are, you exist. But if you exist and you are free of time, then you are not mitya. Because now you satisfy the definition of satyam. You are, you exist, and the one that you are, a definition of satyam is that which exists in past, present, and future, or negatively, that which cannot be negated in past, present, or future. That's what we mean by satyam. Then I fulfill that definition of satyam. But now if we look at, how do I fulfill that definition of satyam? Well, because I am not an object in the creation subject to time or space. Any object within the creation subject to time, space, time means change, time and space means it's there, and I can dissect it infinitely, all these infinite regress and all these things happen. I'm not subject to any of that. And anything that is mitya. Now, mitya means what? it has no being at all, really, to be a second thing. I am, in the end, I am the self of what is termed as mitya. Just like in the limited example of clay pot, there's not a clay and pot. The relationship between the clay and the pot is non-dual, because there is no second thing called the pot. So like that, the relationship of myself to this infinite display of Namarupa is non-dual. Because there's not a second being there, this creation being mitya, it has no being of its own. I am its bottom line. And the bottom line, where we cannot go any further, is what actually is. And what actually is myself, conscious being, which is free of Namarupa. Free of Namarupa, because Namarupa, name and form, is mitya. And therefore, the only thing here is one conscious being, which is the truth of myself and the truth of every Namarupa. Every Namarupa, the whole creation, Ishwar, everything, is mitya, will resolve in this one non-dual substance, which is me. The substance, if we want to use the word substance, it's just kind of an odd word to use for limitless conscious being. And so now, how do I know for sure that I am non-dual? Is only if I can recognize for myself the irrefutable mityatva of the creation, means my mind can't get out of it, the fact that this is mitya. You have to know all of the logics. All of the logics are there so that you can understand. You can't just say, oh, the Shastra says it's mitya, so it's mitya. Then I don't really know for sure, because I don't really know what mitya is. And also, you can't even know what the word mitya is referring to without understanding the adhishtana, the thing that it depends on for its being. Right? And so that means I have to, using the pramanas, I have to recognize the fact, not as a hypothetical or not as a theory, but the reality of my own changeless nature, absolutely free from nama-rupa, absolutely free from subject-object differentiation. I have to see it. My buddhi has to differentiate, really, itself, and differentiating itself, it differentiates the whole creation, really. It differentiates its mityatva, you know, from the truth of itself, which is me, you know. And then that mitya buddhi, you know, then, you know, deals with the mitya world. But that has to be recognized in order for me to know with absolute certainty. So there's two things that I have to recognize myself. I have to recognize the mityatva of the world, including the body, mind, sense organs, and all my thoughts and all of that. And then I have to have inquired into that recognition sufficiently so that my mind has no other objections to come up with. The objections are the what we call the purvapakshas. Purvapakshas means, okay, you're saying the Shastra is saying this, and I see it also, but why couldn't it be like this? You know? Or why couldn't it be like that? Because until these doubts are cleared, assuming in one sense, assuming that shravana has taken place and the doubts aren't just, what is the Shastra saying? What does it really mean? How am I really Brahman? You know, those are doubts that involve utilizing the Upanishads as a pramana. And so then you see clearly that there's another kind of doubt. Yeah, that's what the Upanishads say, but isn't there some way it could be another way also? And so then you just have to respect your mind. This knowledge is for your mind, which sometimes we don't really grasp the significance of that. Any doubt you have is your doubt, and that doubt has to be resolved. And so a very important part of the teaching is the being able to bring up those doubts. And you probably noticed that in the teaching itself, many doubts, it's called Purvapaksha Siddhanta, many doubts taken from the Upanishads or the Prakarna Granthas themselves are brought up and answered. You know. And in the Upanishads and the commentaries, doubts are brought up and answered, brought up and answered, brought up and answered in kind of a very systematic way. And so that takes care of a lot of your doubts. But then there can be lingering ones. And also you can, this is what I used to notice, sometimes, so often, as many of you have mentioned, you know, you have a doubt, and then almost immediately the teacher is addressing that doubt, because there's a logical progression, a normal logical progression of doubts that it's obvious, it's appropriate for that doubt to come up. It comes up, and it's appropriate for the teacher to answer it also as it comes up. So that happens a lot. But then we have these outliers, you know, where you have this doubt and it's not just being answered immediately. And so that's what the satsang is for. Satsang and this inquiry that is outside of the classroom, you know, outside of the actual teaching, is there. So what we call these outliers, these doubts that you have that aren't being addressed, can be directly addressed here and now. So that your mind can be released of that, and it might take two or three times that your mind can be released of it, whatever, when it is, then you're available for teaching again. Otherwise, what tends to happen, at least in my case, is I would be listening, but this doubt would be kind of twirling around in there. Yeah, but what about this? You know, and so those are the doubts that need to be brought to satsang, so that you don't have to wait with them. And sometimes they hang on for a while because there's an order in terms of your own progression of understanding. You know, and so before I can answer this doubt, before the student, before I can answer this doubt, I have to have cleared this doubt and this doubt, or I'm not that doubt is not ready to be answered until these things are answered. Of course, I don't know that, so I kind of have to find my way, and then I'm ready for that doubt. So it's where all our minds are different. We have kind of different routes. For some people don't even, a certain doubt they don't even have, or that it's just lying there in the unconscious. And other people say have that doubt, and they have, it's just different for everybody. So, can you explain aparoksha one more time?
Yeah.
And this goes into how do we know something is non-dual also. This is an important point. In terms of the means of knowledge that we have available to us, right? The two that we know really are pratyaksha. That means that which gives me direct knowledge, basically my sense organs and any of the types of vrittis that my mind is capable of having, like imagination or the emotions as they come up, you know, or thoughts. Inner child work, all of these things that are immediate and direct because they are a vritti in the mind. Right? There's a capacity of the mind to have a vritti, and that vritti being sattva immediately reflects consciousness, so it is immediately known. There's no other process that comes in. So either it's direct because my sense organs are falling directly on the object, so there's nothing intervening, or there's a type of vritti or thought modification that's coming up that is immediately known. That's called sakshibhasya. These things are, these feelings and experiences and imaginations and meditative states are all directly immediately known. So we know that. That's called pratyaksha. It means it's directly immediately experienced with nothing intervening. All of the other ones are called paroksha. So we've got pratyaksha, direct immediate. Prati means in the vicinity of the aksha of the sense organs. And paroksha means away from the sense organs. And so all of the other means of knowledge that we have are one form or another of paroksha. They're not direct. Like if I see smoke and infer fire, I'm not seeing the fire. I have to see the smoke and make an invariable relationship which makes an invariable relationship with fire, so I know that fire is there. And all of them are like that. Even the, in most cases, the shabda pramana, you know, like if I am, and this is, we do most of our learning through words, through books that we read, through the news that we listen to. You know, we're not having that experience ourselves, but somebody else is relating it to us. Or we didn't gain that knowledge by ourselves, but other people, we're standing on the shoulders of other people who have gained that knowledge. That's all indirect. You have Shraddha in that knowledge when you have Shraddha in the person or the professor or the writer of the textbook, you know, who you view as an authority, and so you take their word for it. Like, for instance, if you're studying, you know, chemistry or biology or history, you know, all of these type of things, if you have Shraddha in the one, in the authors of the book, then you have some respect for what's being written, but it's all totally indirect. So anyway, there's one type of Shraddha that is not indirect. And that's because it's not indirect because it is what we call, it is because it is self-evident. And so here, that's why we say this knowledge is aparoksha. The means of knowledge with the knowledge is aparoksha because it is not indirect. And it's also not pratyaksha because you're not having a subject-object relationship with it to make it known. Anything that's pratyaksha, even though it's immediate, I need to have a means of knowledge that gives me the vritti so that I can illumine that vritti. Gives me the thought, now I have to illumine the thought. If I'm not illumining the thought, the thought isn't self-evident. So I need consciousness to illumine the thought. I need a pramana to give me the vritti, you know, which I then illumine. So that's how pratyaksha works. But yourself is not an object to be illumined. Nor is it an object somewhere else to have indirect knowledge of. Yourself is here, right now, not as an object, but as the very subject, as conscious being itself. So why can conscious being itself be known without a pramana? Means without a pramana that is objectifying it. It doesn't need that because it is self-evident. So now, in order for me to, we're going to divide this into two now. In order for me to have a self-experience, I don't need my pramanas to objectify the object to give me a vritti so that I can know, so that I can experience myself. Right? For all of these things, you need a means of knowledge that gives you a thought modification, which then is illumined by yourself. By the self, right? But do I need a means of knowledge to illumine myself so that I can have the experience of myself? He said, not at all. Because yourself is consciousness itself. It is its own experience. So there is no subject-object necessary. There is no pramana necessary. You are self-shining, right? As consciousness. So the self-experience is already a paroksha. Just the self-experience, it's aparoksha. It doesn't require any means of knowledge for you to have the self-experience. But this self-experience, which is what it is, whether you have knowledge or don't have knowledge, is because of the ajnanam, which is natural to the maya upadhi, and therefore called avidya, from the ignorance or ajnanam from the standpoint of the jiva, there is an avidya, an ajnanam between your self-experience and your mind. There is ajnanam as though covering yourself from the standpoint of the mind, which causes the very same self-experience that is there for the jnani or for the ajnani or for the animals or for the mosquitoes. The very same self-experience, because of that ajnanam, is causing a superimposition between myself and the upadis, body, mind, sense organs, etc. That superimposition is there, where the I, the ahankara, comes into play, which correctly labels me as I, as me, correct, but then makes the mistake of identifying me with the body, mind, sense organs, whatever the upadhi is. That's a mistake that has for its cause self-ignorance. Right? And so even though all of us, the me is the same for all beings, for Ishwara, also for Ishwara, the whole creation, the me is the same. The identification with the upadis is different between the jnani and the ajnani, the one who has self-knowledge and the one who doesn't have self-knowledge. It's not a different self, it's not a different self-experience. It's just that for the jnani, the misidentifications caused by ignorance have been eliminated. Right? So those all become mitya. And you realize that the self that you are and have always been is free from time and always will be. So the aparoksha atma that is already there with ajnanam is now the same aparoksha atma that is there without the ajnanam. Right? So when we say the knowledge that you have is aparoksha jnanam, means that, really, to get into just a little bit of depth with it, it means that even the pramana, the means of knowledge themselves, are not really illuminating you. They are removing the ajnanam. Right? You're already there illumined. You're already there. And so what the pramana has to do is remove the ajnanam, the self-ignorance that is causing this misidentification. You know? And so then we say the atma-jnanam, self-knowledge, is really not the attainment of knowledge, but the negation of ignorance. It's called self-knowledge is called ajnana nivritti, the elimination of the ignorance, because the self is aparoksha. That's why when you gain knowledge, you don't say, "Oh, look at what my self is like. You know, it's so neat to have an experience of myself." That's not the experience. It's the recognition that the Upanishads are talking about me, and I am free. The self that I have always been and always will be is free. It's not a new self. It's a self I've always taken to myself to be, but now because of the ajnanam, I have all of these upadis that are superimposed on me. So. Okay. Without jnanam, how does a person develop a big enough heart to be compassionate and kind and generous instead of feeling threatened, attacked, and therefore in need to react and retaliate? Like the Trump-like people. he says, D, Trump. D is for Donald. Okay. Example, D, Trump-like people. Well, you know, sometimes I talk about this, the chapters like 16, 17, and 18 in the Bhagavad Gita, where they're talking about these D-Trumps, right? when you read them, you always think, there he is. There. But really, they're talking about all of these so that we can really notice our own problems, probably in caricature, because very few people can take the issues that we have, you know, to that extreme degree. This where it becomes pathological, you know, where it becomes like what we in psychology we call it a personality disorder. Just a little aside about personality disorders would be interesting and relevant. In the psychology world, we call it in the diagnostic manual that we use. We divide this diagnostic manual, it's called the DSM. We divide it into really two types of disorders only. And then each type has many disorders within it. The two types are what we call the personality disorders, and then we call the other one just the neurotic disorders. The neurotic disorders, people call it like this among ourselves. You know, we are garden variety neurotics. Mm-hmm. It's just like, you know, in your garden, you have many types of flowers in the garden. So like that for us, we have many, many, many different types of neuroses. Okay? And so we're all garden variety neurotics, and we have different types of neuroses to bigger or lesser degree. But the positive thing about it, because everybody has their traumas and their hurts and their sensitivities, complexes, and all of that. But for us garden variety types with this neuroses, the difference between a neuroses and a personality disorder is that we're not comfortable with these neuroses. They're painful to us. They cause pain. They cause hurt. They cause guilt. They cause discomfort. And we want to change. They're not behind our ego or are not behind our identification, you know. And so they're actually cause experiences that I am having that I don't want to be having. Right? And so such a person who has, you know, like say we have like a lot of inner child work to do, or we have different set types of sensitivities that we'd like to overcome, or what we'd like to be able to keep people outside. Like I was saying in the meditation today, we can keep them outside, so I have some space, some objectivity, or being able to give other people space and objectivity, all of that. These are things that we really want so that we can be free of these painful problems. Those are the neurotics, and so there's many, many different varieties that this DSM manual, this diagnostic manual, lists. And of course, within each variety, there are, you know, different, like they might have 10 characteristics for each particular illness. And say you only need 5 of these. Of these 10, if you have 5 of them, then you're such and such, you know. Or some of them will be 10, and you only need like 3. If you have 3 in any combination, then that's, we would diagnose you as that. You know, some need more, some need less. So there's another type. And so anyway, to sum this up, this garden variety neurotics, the first part, which is the majority of everybody except for a small number in the population of people, therapy, going to therapy, going to analysis, doing inner child work, working on yourself in the innumerable ways that we have is very effective, can be so helpful. But that's not even the main criteria. The main criteria is I want to do that. I want to work on myself. You know, even if it's a tenacious problem, I want to work on it. I want to solve that problem. But for the personality, people that suffer from the personality disorders, that is much more difficult because they say, just in psychology, that type of disorder happens very young in life. In the first, like, 1, 2, or 3 years, often it happens. And what that means is that it's almost as though the disorder is almost structural. So that really happens earlier than more of a healthy ego development. And so it's kind of underlying that. Whereas you kind of mature and, you know, you gain your little buddhi and you can differentiate one thing from another and you can perform as you're younger, all different kinds of very difficult discernments. Like say if now I was to pick up this pine cone, here's a pine cone right here, if everybody can see it, it's got this pine cone, and I pick this up and I go like this. Okay, now the pine cone's gone. There is no pine cone. That's one young age. There's no pine cone. There's nothing to look for. There's no, where's the pine cone? The pine cone is gone. Okay. But when they're a little older, then if I go like this, they'll go around and look for the pine cone behind my back. Right. So these are developmental things that happen at a relatively young age. But now think of it for a child. Like, the mother is here playing with the child, and she gets up and goes out into the kitchen. She's not here anymore. Where is she? You know? And then the child will start crying, because where is she? Where is she? You know? Whereas when she's a little bit older, and the mother goes into the kitchen to get her a bottle or whatever it is, you know, a little bit older, then she knows mom has gone to the kitchen. I can't see her because she's in the kitchen. Not even with the words. They know that, you know. And so say these are kind of fundamental building blocks that happen as the personality becomes a little, as the child becomes a little bit older, and we always notice that. And by the time they're between the 2 and 3, you know, the terrible twos. In the States, we call them the terrible twos. You know, then the child is kind of realizing that it has a little bit of power. And it can do things, like it can say no No. Do you want this thing? No. It loves that word. It also, because it means something. It can draw its own little boundaries and play with that, you know. Yes and no. And then also it has a, it learns this. It starts to, so the mom is here, the mother is here, father for that matter. And then the little two-year-old, two-and-a-half-year-old, it starts moving away, you know. And it'll, so it's used to just being here, being held onto. That starts to move away. So it moves away like 2 or 3 feet, and then it looks back. And the important thing is that, okay, it's 2 or 3 feet away, but mom is still looking at me, right? And so you're still looking, okay, I'm going farther. And then it's just wandering around out there, but always checking back, you know? But it's expanding its territory and its own individuality. So all of these are developmental issues, and all of them can kind of be thwarted or blocked along the way from a very young age. And that can create problems in the psyche, in the structure of the psyche. And that will manifest in different types of personality disorders. So, I mean, I just told a very few little things just to give you the idea. But so what a personality disorder is for that person, the way they're behaving and feeling and thinking, there's no self-recrimination. There's no really guilt. Because how I feel and how I'm interpreting the situation is what is correct. And these people are wrong. And it's not because they're making excuses. You know, it's not like I'm not taking blame for that. It's your fault. No, as though I'm trying to hide, you know, and I don't want to face up. It's not about facing up or hiding. It's your fault. You are hurting me. It's what you are doing. You are stopping me from progressing, or you are stopping me from getting the things that I want. It is your fault, you know. Never my fault. And what people don't understand, since I'm making this up, but say 90% of the people are garden variety neurotics, like all of us, okay? We have like guilt and a sense of dormant. We have a conscience that is always kind of coming into play, and then we're always trying to, you know, find ways to overcome our pain and things like that. And so for us, it's how can I become bigger or better or whatever, you know? How can I take care of this? But for a person who has a personality disorder, they're not able to do that. That conscience or guilt or shame, which is not a very nice emotion, but anyway, all of them are still hurtful. They don't have that. You know? And so what happens here, and what's happening with somebody like Donald Trump, is that we think he's doing it on purpose. That he's just blaming everybody else, and he's very vindictive and all of this, but he knows what he's doing. But the scary part is that he really doesn't. I just read a book by a group of psychologists that went to, they had a, I think it was in Yale, they had a big conference where they, not psychologists and psychiatrists, they decided to, they had a duty to warn the public about Trump and to make, and to help people to understand their what they feel he's, their diagnosis of him. And so 17 actually quite well respected and well-known people got together, and they held a conference. And the first part of the conference was whether or not they had a right to do this. Because normally we would not do that, and we wouldn't also analyze from a distance as a psychologist. It's kind of against the rules, unless there is a duty to warn. And their feeling was that, collective feeling, was that they needed to do this because they had a duty to warn. And so each one, 17 of them, ended up writing an article, a chapter for the book called the something like The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump is the name of the book. And there's 17 psychiatrists and psychologists who are writing, each one is writing a paper. And it makes, this is one of the very important points that it makes, is that, you know, people think that he can do differently. And that is really not necessarily true. Or they think that he is just threatening and may not really be meaning what he's saying. You cannot take that for granted. It's actually an excellent book, not just for understanding him, but it gives a depth of understanding to that possibility, the possibility that the person themselves is not really able to make the type of choices and decisions that you would, and the majority of people would be in agreement on, that to make, you know, so that we can all identify with each other. And yeah, he did that, but I'm sure he's really worried about it and feels terrible about it. No, that's what we have to understand, and that's why these psychologists have done this duty to warn. And this, what the type of suffering that he goes through, it can be, it's called like malignant narcissism is one of the main things that he can't see outside of his own perspective. But anyway, there's a big issue with that. And it's important to understand it, that that thing exists, and maybe to have a little training in that so that you don't always expect a person, you know, to have the same type of internal structure with, you know, guilt and sorrow and, you know, wanting to make amends and all of these kind of things that are usually natural, or wanting to improve and let your heart become bigger. That most of us, especially as mumukshus, you know, or jnanis, we're always working on that, to let your heart become as big as Ishwara. So I don't see any of us don't have, none of us have personality disorders. But you don't even know that they exist, that's what I'm saying. And so then that also becomes hard when you're dealing with somebody who has a personality disorder and you don't think of it like that. You think of it, what a jerk that person is, you know, as though they can be otherwise. I mean, it just gives your heart a little bit more space. So the question again is, that's all because of Donald Trump. So without jnanam, how does a person develop a big enough heart to be compassionate and kind and generous? I think because there are saints that don't have knowledge, I think one of the things is that the commitment to Dharma itself, or that religious commitment to God, to Ishwara, really helps with that. And the reason is, if the commitment is to Dharma, your commitment is to something other than all of the raga dveshas out here. And when the commitment isn't to the likes, fulfilling the likes and dislikes, but is to Ishwara and the Lord, kind of like that karma yoga buddhi, if that's your raga dvesha, so to speak, what you're committed to is Dharma, to Ishwara, then the heart can become very, very, very big. Very loving, very big. Because you're the obstructions to that, which is actually natural to you, natural to your own being, the obstructions are way, way limited. You know, it's not like that is your swarupa, that is your nature, to have that wholeness, that fullness, that love and all of that, but things get in the way of it. It's not that you're not that, but the mind gets tied up and hurt in this way or that way, or wants this or want that, wants things to be different, and then you're having to deal with that mind and sometimes acting out of that mind. That's what's normal. But even so, the first thing, the biggest relief within samsara is Dharma and your relationship with Ishwara or your Ishtadevata, that can create a very loving, loving heart. And then, if you have self-knowledge, that even gives you a relief, even from Dharma, a Dharma. Not that you don't naturally choose Dharma, but we can also we don't have the concern. Dharma is natural for you. When you're not unhappy, when you're full, Dharma is a natural expression. Dharma is Ishwara's expression. The whole expression is an expression of Dharma. So your natural expression is Dharma, you know? And so you're not Some of them, is this dharmic, is that dharmic? You just do the best you can, and that's good. So, because what is natural to you is dharma, not a dharma. It's natural for you to care about people, not to not care. If you don't care about people, it's sadhana. For all of us, for me, if I'm not caring about somebody, or I don't like somebody, or somebody's causing me pain, or blah, 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 that's sadhana. That's not something that we say, well, that's just the way it is. They deserve that. That's not what we can do. We can't do that anymore. Because we know too much to that. You have to be with yourself. You have to be with your issues, you know. But one thing, yeah, just to finish on that. One thing, you know, like I brought it up today in the meditation, that I find personally so powerful, so I'm just going to spend a couple minutes on it, is for me, if somebody is hurting me, or if there's a contentious relationship, or somebody in my past or whatever that is a negative, there's a negative relationship there. One thing that I find so effective is when I say, you know, just first of all, you just relax your body and have that welcoming, so that you kind of get in a space where you're with yourself. And then you bring up the image of that person that is causing you pain, or you have a long, kind of painful relationship with that person. And if you just hold that image for a while, you know, well, with welcoming, don't try to make it any different, don't try to push it away, don't try to bring it in, just allow the image of that person to just be there, and kind of relax the buddhi and let happen what happens. So what will happen is you will feel, and this is the initially, you know, you'll probably feel the pain or the hurt or the anger or whatever it is will come up, because there's that person. So that person, that image is associated with that pain. Right? But what happens is when you have that image, here's the image in your mind, the image is kind of there in the buddhi. It's not the physical person, it's just the image. But the pain that comes up, or the anger, or whatever it is embodied. It comes up in your body, you know. It doesn't come up in the image. It comes up in the body. And so now there's a real viveka available there between this image and the pain that has taken place in the body. You know, it's the affect. And then what you do is you can turn toward that affect and do that, and that work on that, you know, tell me what this is really about. Because now it's totally dissociated from the image. So it's a very good way to just get in touch, then you can let the image go or stay, it doesn't make any difference. Now you're working on what you're holding inside, you know. And what you're holding inside is what continually is landing on that image, whether the person comes near you, it's projected on immediately, or do you think about them, it's projected immediately, those feelings rise up, you know. So you kind of can't, every time you think of that person, it will trigger those feelings, because that's how it's set up. So two things happen. One, the first thing is that it differentiates those feelings from the image, right, so that you can work on the feelings themselves. And if you hold that image for long enough, the image itself and your mind is relaxed and welcoming, then the feelings drop off the image. The association between the image and those inner feelings breaks. So it's a really amazing meditative technique to try. And it frees you from having projecting the image on the person, and it also gives you a really a deep understanding of what you're holding inside.
Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.